Hi, my name is Moshe Kindler, and I'm the publisher of The Jewish Link.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Kratz. I'm editor of The Jewish Link.
And you're on The Jewish Link Pitch Meeting Podcast.
So The Jewish Link Wine Guide has an annual pitch meeting where we're able to use our podcast platform to talk about the Wine Guide, which is our annual magazine. We're very proud of it. It's an 80-page glossy that includes features about kosher wines worldwide. Yes, right there. Thanks, Guy. And we're very proud and happy to welcome Guy Eshel, winemaker at Dalton Winery, and Alex Haruni, who is CEO and owner of Dalton Winery in the north of Israel.
Upper Galilee.
Yes. It's a beautiful region. I'm so grateful to have been able to come visit you all in person last year, almost exactly a year ago.
That's right.
And it's a beautiful place, and it's amazing for me to be able to see your work in action, and also now, just a year later, to tell you how well your wines are hitting in the community, in our magazine, and within the winemaking world, really at every price point. That's one of the things I always say about Dalton. Just any bottle you buy, from the $20 to the $60, $80, $100, it's going to be delicious.
That's great news. I mean, we've worked very hard to get to that point.
Yeah, I agreed. And I also said before that I've known your wine going back also 15 years or more, and it's just gotten better and better. Like, really, kol hakavod, and thank you for your work.
We're very happy to be here with you.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. And thank you also for being with us at the Jewish Link Wine Guide Grand Tasting on Tuesday. It was amazing. And we're sorry we weren't able to present you with your award then, but we're going to give it to you later, I guess. So sorry about that. I realize we also don't have it ready on the podcast, but we're very grateful for it. We basically provided Hakarat HaTov gifts for the Israeli winemakers who came in for the tasting, saying just really we wanted to express our appreciation for winemaking in the conditions of this past year. So could you talk a little bit about those conditions?
It's been a challenging year because first of all, When the 7th of October came around, we didn't really know what to expect. You know, we'd come up to work, we didn't know how long we'd have to stay, if we're going to complete a full day of work or leave early because of alarms. We did spend some time in bomb shelters, and then also some of our staff was drafted onto the reserves.
Right.
Like right from the first day. So our head viticulturist, Nahum, has been on reserves ever since the 7th of October. He does his community. He's like in his community watch.
Mm-hmm. They have Kitat Konanut.
It's called Kitat Konanut. It's basically a team of armed civilians that stay and protect the area in their town or in their village. And then one of our production manager, he was also in the reserves for a while, for about the first 80 days, and now he's returned, but he may be called back again if things start warming up in Lebanon. And then the way it affected us, like from day one, was basically it was right at the end of harvest, so mm-hmm. you know, we couldn't press things when we wanted to at the end of fermentation. The whole process was a bit slower. We couldn't work as much. Bottling got delayed by about a month, but we had to really, really work hard to kind of like make for the lost bottling days and the work mm-hmm. days that we had. And now we're more, you know, it's there's a flow to the work, and we've gotten used to the situation, which is, you know, not a great thing to do, because it's like you know, it's a situation that is not normal, right? So, but we're managing to work, and we come up to the winery every day and do our best to get the wines ready and made as well as we can, and we hope we can keep doing that for the rest of the year. In terms of farming the vineyards, there is about 50 acres that will be that are currently unfarmed because they sit right on the Lebanese border, and it's a bit dangerous to get to them. So we'll see. You know, if things are quiet, we may be able to farm some of those vineyards, but it will be a challenging year ahead of us.
Wow.
Yeah, we haven't seen the last of, you know, of those challenges yet.
I think it's characterized by a lot of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And that's, reminds me to an extent of COVID. Mm-hmm. And we've learned the lessons from COVID as well, because with COVID, we just froze the business for 2 months and realized that we got so backed up on work that this time, although despite the uncertainty, we've made the decision just to keep on working all the time and doing what we do. We've lost business. I mean, in October, November, after Sukkot, were completely dead months. The whole country was grieving. Nobody was interested in drinking or consuming anything. Things have picked up. It's amazing how people get used to a situation that we have. I mean, I come up, guys there every day. I come up to the winery now 3 times a week. And you've got mushroom clouds and explosions going off to your left and to your right, to the east and to the west. I've had explosions that I can see from my office window, sirens, and you go into the bomb shelters. We've had to buy more bomb shelters as well because people are working, so they need somewhere closer from the bottling line, for example. Things that you would never think about. We've contemplated buying armor jackets and helmets for our vineyard staff.
Wow.
It's all sorts of things that you don't think about, but you need to think about, and you just get it done. We've rented warehouse space outside of the Galil, just in case, so we can house a lot of our stock there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, but we made a decision, and I think it's an important decision, that we continue working, that everybody comes to work. Having people just sit at home doing nothing is much, much worse.
And yes.
Right.
Thank God we've had the opportunity to keep people employed, keep them at work. We've came out of Schmitter as well, which was a huge pressure on the winery to get all the new 2023 vintage wines out in time, into the markets, into the export markets. We get them in time for Israel, but to have them on the boat in time for Purim.
And
that was a huge, huge challenge, which the winery stood up to. Guy and his team did a really great job getting everything ready. And we have a handful of wines that weren't going to be ready in time, but all the quick drinking whites, they're all ready and they're all here as well.
Actually, why don't we pause the questioning and move to a celebratory bottle, was one of the things you hustled to get ready for us. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
So and it's tell me about it and let's
this
open
is a,
it.
I mean, this is a wine that was made under the specter of war. I mean, literally from, we started making it in October.
Yeah.
So this is really a war wine. This is Guy's, really did a great job getting it ready in time and the concept and everything.
It's a pink Petnat. Just give it a minute for the sedimentation to jump down again. They'll sink and then we'll pour it. Basically what it is, it's a naturally fermented sparkling wine. And the way it ferments is it's made from Zinfandel grapes that are pressed and fermented, and then they finish their fermentation in the bottle, leaving a little bit of yeast sediment. But it's kind of like a cider, between a cider and a wine, or a bottle conditioned beer. It's a lot of fun. It's very fruity. Yeah, and there's no sulfur added, so it's a completely natural, fun beverage.
Somebody asked us actually at the tasting on Tuesday if we would ever do a category of no sulfur added ranked wines. And I basically said, not next year, but maybe the year after.
Maybe
because
in the future.
We're getting more and more of these opportunities, including we have a We have a, it's essentially a Margaux wine from France that is sulfite-free kosher. Oh, wow. Just came into us. It's called Plume de Palomé.
Okay.
Palomé, I think.
There is actually, you know, in the non-kosher market, it's quite a big movement. Like
right.
Natural wine. And with kosher natural wines, I don't think there are any yet. We do have a partner that we work with, and we make together a kosher natural wine for her brand, which is made from organically farmed grapes, and we make like a barrel a year. But it's a
very very small
it's a very
part
very,
of our production.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Generally, we use.
Yeah, you can pour.
Yeah, I saw the sediment go down. It's very interesting how that happens. These are the dead yeast cells from the production, which I really only read about in my WSET books, and it's fun to get a chance to see them.
Yeah, so.
And it's a beautiful color. These are red Zinfandel grapes.
Zinfandel, so it does, when we pick it early for the pet net purposes, it does have very high acidity. It creates a wine with lower alcohol.
Mm-hmm. What is the alcohol? Is it 11%?
Yeah, 11%.
Yeah, so I definitely smell the yeast.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing I'm getting, and then a sweetness behind that of tropical fruits.
Yeah,
is it's interesting that you would get tropical from Zin in the first thing, but I know you're into Zinfandel. Is that
a
thing for you, right?
We
that's
also
your
have coast to coast.
Right.
And I also, you know, grew up in California and studied winemaking in California and worked there in the first, 10 years of my professional career. And I was always very connected to their unique grape that they grow there, those old vines Zinfandels.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Dalton Winery has a beautiful old vineyard with Zinfandel that was planted in 2000. They've been one of the first wineries in Israel to produce Zinfandel, and we're probably some of the last wineries to produce Zinfandel in Israel at the moment. It's quite diverse. Like, it makes a very spicy red wine, but it's also great for rosé. That's why there's so much white Zinfandel in the States.
Right.
And here we just, I picked it for its acidity and for its freshness and its zippiness. So it's quite a crisp and fun beverage. Because Pet Net is a style that is called Pétillant Naturel, which is a naturally fermenting sparkling wine. And we do not disgorge our pet nets. That means you'll find some kind of yeast sedimentation in the bottle. The first few months after the wine has been has completed its fermentation, it will taste a little bit yeastier, but that also tends to evolve and change as the wine ages in the bottle.
Okay. Let's give it a taste. Baruch Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Chaim Borei Pri
HaGafen. Amen.
Yeah, it's lovely. And I got a little piece of yeast as a bonus. Must have been the first glass poured. It's so fun, and it's refreshing and served cold. It always has to be served cold.
Yep.
It's just yeasty. It has this summer citrusy beer sense. So it's really a great wine for people.
It does have some citrus
who like beer.
Yeah.
Like a transitional, like you want to make a Hagafen over a beer, this is your wine.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Like a cider.
Yeah.
It's very refreshing. It's very nice.
Really, it's strong, strongly, it's beautiful.
It will be ready for, you can already find it here in selected stores in the U.S. I've already seen it on the shelves here, and I think it'll get better over time as well. It'll continue to develop. It's a great wine, and it's ready for the summer. So, when spring comes around, make sure you grab your bottle of Pet Net.
It's a lot of fun.
It also has a white sibling that we...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We started making it white, and then this year we decided to make a rosé. And the white's quite well established in the market now.
It's lovely. I like that one as well. And I think I can't guarantee, but I think you will see these in the rankings. At least the white one for sure, and I can't remember at the rosé. But I wanted to tell you also that the Dalton wines that you sent in January for our rankings tastings in the wine guide, as you know, we taste wines annually. It takes about a week and a half. It's a little bit nuts, and like my kids are like, what happened to my mom, stuff like that. And like all of our six judges really give a lot of time, and they're all volunteers. And we tasted this year 560 wines.
Wow.
In the course of about a week, because of the time frame, we wanted to be done with everything before our event so that we could award some of the wines. As you saw, we provided medallions on the bottles. Really, those were the top 100 bottles, right, that ranked, but there are more that ranked because we are still in production of the magazine right now. In fact, I have like probably 15 emails about the magazine going on as we speak, but we're here to celebrate the launch of it now. And so hopefully by the time everyone reads this, we're going to be reading it along with everyone else, and we'll have launched it. But I just wanted to tell you now that the Dalton wines did very well across tastings, including a number one for your estate Merlot. Okay. And I know it's so funny because everyone's like, Merlot, you know, Merlot has a bad reputation because of the movie Sideways that just set back Merlot years. And I'm sure the people in Pomerol like are really, really mad at that guy. but Merlot is a grape that people either love it or hate it. People, you know, I actually wonder what you think about it, Guy, because you've been able to make beautiful wines from Merlot.
Making beautiful wines really has to do with having beautiful vineyards that you farm by yourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we are known for, actually. And after about, 15 or almost 20 years of Dalton existing as a winery, in 2009, we really changed the way we treat our vineyards. Our vineyards are now mostly in-house managed. About 80% of our vineyards are managed, and the rest we buy from contract farmers. It allows us access to fruit at every quality level and at the top quality level, because we control everything that happens. We grow specifically for the wines that we want to produce. Mm-hmm. And just like this Merlot, you know, it comes from top fruit that we grow in the Golan, in the Upper Galilee. It's made as a very kind of fruit-forward style wine, bottled with after 12 months. Mm-hmm. So
that gives it a little time in the bottle to thicken with viscosity changes.
Yeah. Some go into barrels, some stay in stainless steel. Oh, okay. It's I try with the estate Merlot for it to be like a very fruit-forward style. Mm-hmm. Very approachable, yet tasty. So I think Merlot does very well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what vintage was the one that received the number one, but 2021 was a fantastic year.
I think so.
It was a year with relatively lower yields, and it also had quite stable weather throughout the growing season, with no big surprises, lots of rain, almost till the beginning of the summer. So it was a very good year for wine in general, 21. We did not have enough whites that year, so we had very, very little whites even before Shemitah, which is usually when we start, stocking up on wine. The year was quite limited, but great quality. So I think
it also helps. In the family collection and what was the reserve series, we stopped making a Merlot reserve.
Okay.
So all that good quality fruit that used to go there is now
good point
distributed between Alma and the estate series, which makes those two wines just much better.
Right.
We never felt that the Merlot was really good enough to go into a really expensive wine. So that good fruit that used to go there is now come down into the estate.
Made it better as well.
That's very interesting. Yes. Yeah. The Dalton Deep Red is a great wine. And I actually, can I ask you, I think you explained it to me probably two other times, but the Deep Red used to be crimson.
Correct.
And yes. Before... And then there was a Scarlet, which is just regular red.
Yeah.
So what are those breakdowns of grapes? And sorry if this is a little nerdy.
So the Deep Red is the Deep Red. It will be a
it's a Bordelaise blend.
It's a Bordelaise blend, so it's got.
This is the red.
This is the red. Sorry.
Okay,
I'll tell you.
The Deep Red has got Cabernet and Merlot and Cabernet Franc.
Okay,
and the red. This one has Shiraz and Grenache
and Carignan.
Okay.
The other thing that Guy does. Is he takes a little bit of that and pours it into the other one, and a little bit of the other one and pours it into there. So there are like small percentages of other grapes that we tend not to talk about, but we don't mention it, but it just really picks up the wine and rounds off the edges and makes the wines really, really delicious.
And then how is that different from your Afsufa line?
Mm. That with the Alma?
Yeah, well, how does the Alma differ from the...
So Alma are classic blends that are inspired by the wines we love from the world, like the Bordeaux blend and the Rhone style blend, the classic Mediterranean blend. So it's really like a Galilean, like Côte du Rhône style wine.
Right,
you know,
you got
it's mostly Grenache and Syrah and some Carignan, and it's a very fresh wine. Almost no oak age. It's aged in a large wooden cask and in cement tanks.
Mm-hmm.
So
no Morvedra in the upper Galilee?
We used to work with Morvedra, but the Morvedra vineyard that we had is now going into our estate rosé.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
It just makes a better rosé than a red wine in Israel, especially the type of Morved that we have planted. I didn't find it just made the cut for the quality I wanted to receive in the red wine. So use it for rosé. It does a great job there.
I believe your rosé this year, just so you know, it's in the top three of our rosés.
Wow.
So you know.
The estate or the Alma?
I believe estate.
Okay.
I believe. But don't get... I feel like Michal, my deputy editor, is like, why did you tell them everything? But by the time we get to the point where we release the podcast, everyone will have the magazine in front of them,
cool.
and we'll be able to confirm. But I believe it just did very well. I don't believe we had your.
No, the Alma.
We might have gotten your. Mm-hmm.
We brought the Alma with us.
Oh, okay.
On the plane on Sunday.
Oh, cool.
A week after.
Yeah. Okay, right. Yeah. So I haven't seen the Alma Rosé yet.
Yeah,
okay.
We brought it with us. We brought Alma White. So speaking of blended. So apart from the Alma Rosé, which is a complete kind of wine that I had invented the first year I came to Dalton. You know, we had one rosé up until 2015, which was kind of sweet, and it was made from Syrah and some Cabernet and from Merlot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
rings a bell.
It wasn't really the style that I wanted to make, so we came up with the Alma Rosé. I told Alex, let's try something else, and we did like something very, very light.
Mm-hmm.
We used to call it the Vin Gris, which is like a very like lightly pressed rosé. And I used Pinot Gris that was skin contact for about 24 hours, and Grenache, which makes a very, very pale rosé.
Right, like salmon.
Yeah, so we just continued that, and now the Alma rosé is that same wine. It's about 50-50. It gets a lot of texture from the Pinot Gris on the skins, which makes it nice and crisp and kind of salty. And the Grenache is just like very light and very, very quaffable. So it's a fun wine. And that's our second rosé. It's a little bit
exciting.
More expensive, but it's a very, very good rosé.
Okay, so that'll be also available by Purim time or so.
Oh, it's on the boat already.
It's on the boat. Okay, wow.
And then with the Asufa series, that has been something that we've always kind of toyed with the idea. And we released it just on the break of COVID. So it was a bad time to release a brand new series of wine. But somehow it caught on. And in Israel, it does very well, especially in the restaurant scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the intention, to make something different. It's basically a set of contemporary wines, either contemporary blends or different varieties that are non-traditional, like Zinfandel. Mm-hmm. We have the Leventina blend, which is a blend of, it's a regional blend. So mm-hmm. it goes beyond the Galilee. We have Petit Syrah that comes from the Judean flatlands, and then Grenache from the Upper Galilees, Petit Verdot from the Golan, Carignan from the Lower Galilee. So it's like a journey through Israel, and that's why I called it the Leventina, because it's like a journey through the Middle East, the Levant. Mm-hmm.
Lovely. And the artwork on the bottles are just stunning. Also, I should have said that about the Pet Nat too. So beautiful.
Each wine in this Asufa series, we commission a local artist who does the illustration for it, and that will be the wine. So we can take wines in and out of the series, but the idea is that every wine will get a commissioned artwork that speaks the spirit of the wine.
We tell the illustrator about the wine, mm-hmm. we explain the wine to them and what we think it represents and what we're looking for, and they bring us an illustration to coast. It's like, this is the California coastline, Leventina. This is actually a view of the Kinneret.
On the way down from the winery to when we go down to our vineyards in the south, in the lower Galilee. Right. So it's what you see.
Yeah.
And also the Asufa series allows us to make wines that a commercial winery can't put into their normal
standard range.
Mm-hmm. These are good, strong, I'm using the word commercial, but in a good sense, in that, you know, people who want something solid and want something that they're familiar with can go and pick up from the shelf. Mm-hmm. With the Asufa series, we can do more or less what we want in terms of winemaking. And Guy has a free hand, so this year we're going to see some orange wines coming out.
Really?
We've made it in Israel already.
Yeah, in Israel it's released. It's called the Paradisia. It's a skin contact Muscat of Alexandria, which is also a local variety in the Middle East.
Yes.
So it fermented on the skins for about 5 months. Then we don't even press it off. We drain the wine, and then it's aged in amphora and in large barrels as well. So It's a very interesting type of wine.
What's Muscat of Alexandria in other places? There's another name for it, isn't there?
Muscat of Alexandria.
Well, it's in Italy, they call it Zabibbo.
Right, yeah. Right. There's it's
Paradisia
is one of the names as well.
It's got a hundred different names.
Oh, okay.
It's one of those. Right. Is one of
I remember. I think I had a question about that on one of my exams.
Yes,
Paradisia is one.
Yes.
Of
yes.
Okay.
In Sicily, Zabibbo. They use it quite a bit.
Right.
They make Marsala wines from it.
Sure.
If you're familiar.
Yes.
And also in there's an island Pantelleria where they make a sweet wine as well from the Zabibbo.
Okay. Off the coast of Greece or Italy?
Also off the coast of Greece, off the coast of Sicily, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Cool. That's very fun.
Yeah.
We also invested we bought about 6 or 7 amphora.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll have a white wine that's been made and aged in amphora that's also coming out.
So for the non-wine drinkers among us, what is an amphora?
An amphora is a vessel for wine, for storing and fermenting wine that is made from some kind of earth matter, which is either clay or porcelain, or, you know, there's different types of amphoras. You know, in the past, you see the pictures of, you know, these ancient ruins or ancient images of these clay pots with
right,
two handles.
Sort of like,
and they have like a pointy bottom. They're a bit egg-shaped.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Actually, fermenting wine is very nice in them because it does keep a temperature that is consistent. The fermentation, because of the egg shape, usually creates a natural mixing of the wine. That means that that mixing rises the yeast cells from the bottom of the tank to the top, and it also stirs the wine as it's fermenting, creating a lot of texture on the palate.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike a cylindrical shaped tank where everything just sinks.
Right, right. Yeah. So the difference between aging wine in an amphora versus a stainless steel tank or even oak just gives it a different textural component and it enables it an ability to moderate the temperature in a unique way.
Yes.
And I feel like it's gaining in probably every one of the wineries I visited a year ago in Israel. A lot of wineries seem to be experimenting with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys had big ones. Like, yeah, so they're really, really big, right?
They're as tall as a person.
Right, right. Yeah.
1,000, 2,000 liters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
How does it work? If you have, there are some that people have skins in them, and
yes,
some
you can. You
and
can.
Some do not.
You can ferment the wine with the skins or without the skins, mm-hmm. however you wish. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, for instance, they will...
Right.
Ferment their grapes with the skins,
right?
And just leave it for an entire season. The skins, in the meantime, sink to the bottom, and then they'll rack the wine out of the amphoras or the cuvées. That has a different name in every region. They bury theirs in the ground, and then
for temperature.
And they clean them for the following season. Ours are stand up. They have like a they stand on their bottoms, and they're just a little bit more modern. They have a valve that you can mm-hmm. drain the wine, mm-hmm. and then you can clean, and then you can reuse them year after year, mm-hmm. and they last forever as long as you take care of them.
Yeah.
As long as you don't drive into them
with a forklift.
Uh-oh. I'm sure that did not happen in your building.
No.
Certainly.
It did not, no. We really, really watched them.
We had an opportunity to have a nice conversation at our wine event this week with Leah Cohen of LV Wines in Spain, and she said that they're doing a lot of skin aging, not necessarily at LV, but in Priorat is mm-hmm. that's like the stylized thing with one of the great wine regions of the world
mm-hmm.
That they're doing skin aging in amphora. Mm-hmm. So the Carignan for whatever grape they're using
mm-hmm.
Has an opportunity to just sit in a moderate temperature for like. Six months a year, right?
Yeah.
And it's makes for a different kind of experience.
It does. I've been experimenting it on different types of grapes, for instance, with Grenache, and mm-hmm. You do get a wine that in the first few weeks, much of the bitterness and the tannins come out from the skins, mm-hmm. but as time goes by, that gets reabsorbed into the skins, and then the wine comes out quite clear and. And very smooth.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
It happens.
It affects the wine.
Okay.
But aromatically, it also changes the wines. You get more of that skin kind of like earthy characters. Mm-hmm. You lose a lot of the primary fruit, but it's an interesting, I would say, like blending component.
Mm-hmm.
With the Muscat, you do lose some of the intensity from mm-hmm. from those very delicate aromatic, those floral soapy kind of characters.
Okay.
But you do gain a lot of apricot, a lot of tropical fruit, a lot of mango.
Wow.
So
looking forward to tasting that.
That'll be out probably in the summer.
Right. So the orange wine is already available in Israel?
Yes. I like to refer to it like as a skin contact.
Well, okay.
If you say orange, someone's going to expect like a dark orange color.
Yeah.
It's not that dark.
Okay.
Yeah, it's lighter than
it's
amber.
Like, lighter than what?
Amber. Lighter than
amber.
Amber.
Okay.
It's a bit like yellowish.
Right. Color. Lovely. Exciting. Nice. So we actually did have, as you know, in the wine guide, we have articles, about 5, 6, 7 articles over the course of the year, and last year we were it was really all about the appreciating the land and all of the different regions of Israel and the way I guess the way climate affects the wine in your region. This year, as we're moving toward, sort of a winemaker at war image, we're talking more about the efforts you guys are making toward improving kosher wine and having sort of mirroring the secular, commercial, and boutique wine world inside Israel. So that's, it's sort of like one of the things that you guys seem to be doing all the time, constantly reinventing, constantly in bringing in new brands. But one of the things we talked about this year that I declined to do was, and I can't remember if it was Kenny or Gamaliel or somebody, was saying, we got to do a piece about the orange wines in Israel. And I'm like, where are they? We can't do it this year. They're not all here yet. So I'm happy to hear that maybe next year, the year after, yeah, we'll have, as I feel like you guys are a little bit trend setting. So the Yaakov Oria was sort of bringing in orange wines. We now just started to get a lot of them here, and they were tasted and did very well also this year. He's the orange wine guy, as you know, as you may know, for Israel from the American perspective. But we've seen only two or three others so far. So you guys are gonna really start. So we see it as a trend. We recognize it. Hopefully next year, yeah, we'll have a feature about it.
All of these wines, that all of these trends, it's basically going back to how things were.
Oh, okay.
Because 100 years ago, this is how they made white wine. Mm-hmm. They made white wine on the skins.
On the skins, yep, right.
And so we're basically just going back to our roots and exploring how wine, amphora is something that was used thousands of years ago. We're going back and exploring winemaking roots, making the wines a little cleaner, mm-hmm, than perhaps they were before.
Because we have knowledge and, you know.
Because we have the technology to make the, yes, to keep the wines cleaner, but still using the methods that they used 100 years ago. And that's the interesting thing, is bringing old ancestral methods up to date.
Right, right. That's exciting. And I guess, Guy, could we talk a little bit? I feel like we didn't properly introduce you to our readers, but I believe you studied in Davis.
Yeah.
And so your winemaking background, you had a decade of time in the Napa area, things like that. So can you talk a little bit about what the California sensibility, the experience in the technical, like they're really, I mean, basically the best place in the world to study wine, and then bringing that to Israel.
Wow. So yeah, I studied and spent the first 10 years maybe of my wine career in California. The first winery I ever had a job with was Hagafen Cellars. Mm-hmm. And that's where I really fell in love with. That's, you know, when I arrived to Napa and saw those vineyards, that's where everything clicked. Hmm. After a few months there, I applied for another harvest internship that was a lot more hands-on, with a producer in the Stag's Leap region of Napa, oh, wow, Valley, and they were making different types of high-end Cabernets and Sauvignon Blanc, which also was a great experience, learning more about that like premium wine, mm-hmm, industry. And after that, I did another couple of internships at a few wineries, and went on to UC Davis, where I was exposed to this immense world of wines from around the world, meeting peers and other friends that I've made that were interested in natural wine, in alternative winemaking, in alternative varieties. We started like really digging into tasting, and I spent my second year at Davis as the president of the student peer tasting group, which is an official group that the university runs, and they let students run it, and you gain credit and credentials for that. So after I did that for a year, and we were organizing all of the tastings from all over the world, and we really, you know, we brought winemakers, we sourced wines, and we really kind of became more aware of what's happening around the world, I decided to take a scholarship that I received to go and study in France. So I worked for a winery in the Northern Rhone, mm-hmm, and I was very interested in Mediterranean varieties, because my goal always in the back of my mind was to go back to Israel and to work and make wine.
So, you were born in Israel and then grew up in the States?
I grew up in the States in my childhood. And when I was 10, we moved back to Israel.
Oh, okay.
After my military service, I spent a year traveling, kind of a gap year. And then I signed up for the university, but I wasn't really sure what I'd want. Mm-hmm. To mm-hmm. study, and I moved to, and I took a job in California because I was interested in wine, and then I ended up staying there. That's how I got.
So then, fast forward to France.
Mm-hmm. An internship in the Northern Rhone led mm-hmm. me to Australia to a winery that made Northern Rhone style wines in a region that is less known called Canberra. Near the capital of Australia, and they make cool climate wine. So they do Rieslings with Viognier, and they also do Shiraz Viognier, which is Cote Rôti style wines.
Okay,
They're called Clonakilla. It's a very famous Australian wine producer. Mm-hmm. And back to California again, I decided to work for a producer who was very experimental and did a lot of different types of fermentations. And he was in Berkeley. He's called Brock Cellars. I was doing vintage winemaking for them, and I could have stayed, but I decided to move back to Israel. And when I moved back, started to look around where I could, find a position in a winery. Mm-hmm. I met Alex, and I've been at Delton ever since. So we're starting our 10th vintage together this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think you said a year ago when we were together, if memory serves, I think it was you, you said career-wise, if you didn't move then back to Israel.
I would have stayed.
Your career just would have, because you had like all this experience getting ready to, start as a chief winemaker, basically.
So it was either staying there mm-hmm. and developing the career in the States mm-hmm. or moving to Israel. And mm-hmm. I really wanted to go back to Israel. Right. It was my dream to make mm-hmm. wine in Israel. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the right thing to do. I met Alex. It was the perfect fit. Like, he's an super, open-minded, very entrepreneurial kind of CEO and owner of a winery. And when I told him I want to do this and I want to do that, and I want to make sparkling wine and Petnet, and it just it was just a good fit, we can start exploring new things together. Delton is a very dynamic winery as well, so I think there are wineries that just do the traditional portfolio and focus on that. And we've been doing that for 20 years. And I think now we continue to do it, and we do it well, but we also have this playground and this opportunity to start looking into the future and also finding wines that go well with food in the region where we live. Mm-hmm. We live in a warm climate, and planting alternative varieties was just the right thing to do, and making wines that fit that kind of scene, like the Majestic, like all these Petnets that we do, like these light white wines. We have a Semillon, we do a skin contact Muscat, we do a the Amphora fermented Sauvignon, which is very interesting. Mm. We started looking into using ancient varieties.
So oh, yes.
In 2017, we planted about an acre of a local variety called Suriman.
Oh, yes.
Which originates from the northern Golan.
Right. I believe I tasted that last year. Yeah.
And it's very light. It's very kind of spicy. Mm-hmm. And interesting. So I think that was the first wine that we started using amphoras for. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led us to experiment with other wines fermented mm-hmm. in amphoras, because we really wanted it's like using ancient technology with modern technology, and it's an interesting.
And also bringing back those ancient grapes back and using trying to get out of them what might have what it might have tasted like.
Yeah, so by 2 years ago, we planted another vineyard right before Shemitah with a different local variety. And we'll probably continue experimenting with that. You know, not it's not going to be our main production, but it's something that we could definitely create a name for Israeli varieties or regional wines that you can't find anywhere else in the world.
Right. Speaking of things you can't find anywhere else in the world, I wanted to get back to one other thing that I knew I had to mention on the podcast before. But speaking of your entrepreneurial nature, Alex, and the efforts you made toward adding vermouth and gin to the Dalton lines, can you talk a little bit about, I mean, do you still have, you were building a distillery a year ago.
So we are building, it's now, even despite the war, the building has carried on every single day since, throughout this year. We had some planning issues at the beginning, but now we started building. The distillery should be ready in about 6 months, and we'll have brandy, and we'll have whiskey, and we'll have gin, and the vermouth is a collaboration between me and Guy now. It's something that both of us, you know, wine is his thing, but all the spirits and everything is something that I've wanted to do for a while. So the gin's been really well received. We won a prize in the World Gin Awards, a medal for it. In London last month, which was a really, really great surprise. And we're moving forward. We started off-site. I mean, because the place wasn't ready, we off-site, we also distilled our first batch of brandy, non-Schmitter brandy this year. And we've also put in a few barrels. We've also got a few barrels of whiskey. Beginning to age. So that project is happening.
That's exciting. That's I guess I assumed it would be a multi-year process.
This is something,
but
this is something for my grandchildren.
That's exciting. It's great. And it's a beautiful place. I hope that when once Americans become comfortable again to visit again, I hope they'll take the drive and visit you guys up north. It's such a lovely place to visit, and the complex where you all are in, and the setup of your tasting room was very beautiful, and just a really a pleasure to be there. And I hope to get back speedily. And thank you for being with us on the podcast. Thanks for introducing our Jewish Link wine guide for 2024. I can't show the magazine to the screen because we don't have it yet. It's not ready, but by the time this comes out, it will be. And so I really appreciate your time. Thanks for making the effort to come in this year to the Grand Taste. And
thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Can I make a quick plea?
Sure.
I mean, a lot of people ask, how can we get Israel now? And I know that there has been a huge, huge outpouring of support by the American Jewish community for soldiers and for our war activities. But also at home, businesses are suffering. Demand has fallen because half the country's fit men and women, and this war has been characterized by a huge number of women being drafted as well.
Right.
They're all either in the north or the south, which has taken a huge, which has made a huge impact on our domestic market. Now, if you want to help, if the communities abroad want to help us, I think the best way is to buy Israeli products, put Israeli food and wine on your table. We want the trade. We don't want the pity. We're here, we're doing a job, we're going to work every single day. Guy's been there every single day, my staff has been there every single day, I'm there three times a week. We're working very hard, and we want to trade, we want to work because we're working. I think that's really important. Everybody has dinner every day. Put something Israeli on your dinner table, and if you're drinking wine, please,
it should be Israeli wine.
You drank the wines. We've got the wine guide coming out. I'm sure you'll see that the Israeli wines are there in the top 10s, top 15s, top 20s. We've got everything to be proud of. And I think that we give as much as anybody, as any other winery in the world gives. We stand shoulder to shoulder with any other winemaker in the world. And you're not disgracing your table by putting Israeli wines on.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you, and I have written a couple of articles to this effect over the course of, I'm like, for Rosh Hashanah, please, for Sukkot, please, for Hanukkah, please, Thanksgiving, please, right. Israeli wine. We've been, banging that drum, so to speak, and we hope that our readers are listening, we understand the plight, and we understand that that you don't want pity, you want us to support you and keep you in business, so that's what we want as well. And we appreciate your being here, and thank you for your time, and thank you for all the work you've been doing.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us on the Jewish Link Pitch Meeting podcast. If you would like to participate or be in touch with us in any way, please email us at editor@jewishlink.news and follow us and find our podcast wherever you find podcasts.